You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila, delicious and smooth tequila, meaning harmony with the earth. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Bento Box, a full-service marketing and commerce platform that helps restaurants get discovered, make more money, and engage their diners. Join over 8,000 restaurants already using Bento Box today to deliver better hospitality. Visit getbento.com/chef today to get your first month free. That's getbento.com/chef.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Tim and Carissa Mondavi. We'll talk to Tim and Carissa about their winery, family, and a little California wine history. We'll taste the continuum for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Being born into wine is one thing. Being born into the Mondavi family is another. Tim Mondavi's grandfather, Cesare, and dad, Robert, are California wine royalty. Tim grew up around the vines in St. Helena, traveled to Europe, studied wine at UC Davis, and then jumped right into the family business at Robert Mondavi Winery. He had a big influence on their growth and innovation, including Opus One, Luce in Italy, Segni in Chile. Tim eventually moved on to create his own dream winery, Continuum, on Pritchard Hill, with his sister and children, focusing on estate-grown Cabernet Sauvignon-dominated wines. And we're lucky to have Carissa here to talk about that continuum in the generation. So welcome to the Grape Nation, Tim and Carissa. We're talking to Tim in person in New York City, which is nice to be face-to-face. We're up at Skernick Wine and Spirits in Midtown. So before we get into everything, tell everyone why you're in town. I'll tip it off. I mean, you've made your 100th vintage, and you set up a tasting, but tell me why you're physically
well,
here.
First of all, Sam, thank you very much for your enthusiasm for great food and wine and the stories behind it. It is never just the beverage in the glass or the bottle. It is also all those things that go on behind it that give it so much richness and interest and meaning. So thank you for what you do, and thank you for wanting to talk with Carissa and me about our continuum. So in answering your question, we are very proud to be a rare family in America that has come from wine and is still working in wine at the very highest level. And our pursuit is to have Continuum be recognized among the great wines of the world. And I think we're well on our way. I don't know that we'll ever get there. I don't believe in perfection on earth. But I do believe that there's the aspiration for it. And we certainly have that completely filled and in abundance. And aspirations for making it ever better. So Continuum is a great name for what we do because we want to carry on with the best of our family's long history here in America. Knowing that there will be plenty of opportunity for Carissa and future generations to keep making fabulous improvements. So
you did a terrific tasting in New York at the Pierre, and the lineup of wines, which are all connected to you, are amazing. But you made Carissa do all the hard work. The intro, the prep,
yeah,
all that stuff. But let me just tell you, I was sitting there and you did a wonderful job. All right,
thank you.
Here's something that I think is important to me, to you, the show, our listeners. Whether you like it or not, and I think you probably like it, you are a historian and a walking encyclopedia of the Mondavi family and a huge and very important chunk of wine and California wine. So I kind of throw the ball to you to talk to our listeners about this extensive, deep history. I mean, I don't have the luxury of sitting with everyone. I mean, Lamberto Frescobaldi, maybe he trumps you because he's like 11 generations.
But
I mean,
he's 30.
He's 30 generations.
Yeah. 30. Your sister said 11 or whatever. Yeah. But kind of weave, you know, the history in. And you opened eloquently about everything being a continuum. Get me the history to continuum. And then I want to talk to you about the wines. I want to talk to you about farming. I want to talk to you about winemaking, the future, all of that stuff. But sure. Let's lay a foundation with some history.
Sure, sure. Well, I think oftentimes in life, setbacks cause you to try a little harder. And in America, I'll give you a little bit of lay the groundwork about California wine history very briefly, if I can, and then try to commingle my family's involvement in that. But I started yesterday talking about, wine has been spread around the world by the church. It needed wine for the sacraments. And so in 1781, the missionaries, Spanish missionaries, brought wine to California for the first time. But it was the German immigrants that really made things happen. Jean-Louis Vien brought vines into California. But it was the gold rush. It was the gold rush, the discovery of gold in 1848, the gold rush in 1849. San Francisco went from 1,000 people to 25,000 people in a single year. Everything came in.
Thirsty people?
Oh, thirsty people. There were a lot of people, a lot of miners out there, and some got very wealthy and wanted nothing but the best. And so people like Charles Krug. Charles Krug is important to me because I grew up there. But Charles Krug founded his winery in 1861. It's the oldest winery in Napa Valley that's operating. I grew up there. My cousins are still there operating it proudly. 1862, Schramsberg. Jacob Schramm founded Schramsberg. 1874, the Beringer brothers came in and established Beringer wines. 1879 is Inglenook, Finnish sea captain that established Inglenook. But these were the people that really put Napa Valley on the map. They came because of the awareness of the gold rush, but they also saw that Napa Valley had the soil and the climate and the potential to do something wonderful. And so they were the ones that brought fame to Napa Valley. Many others followed, so that by 1919, which is the year of Prohibition, by 1919, the recognition that Napa Valley was doing something special grew to the point where there were 121 wineries in Napa Valley, 18,000 acres of vines in that year, and a reputation for some of the greatest wines around the world. That was an international reputation because tastings in Brussels, in Paris, in London recognized the quality, gold medals all around. So Napa Valley was among the very best. But Prohibition changed all of that. Prohibition devastated the industry, not only from an infrastructural perspective, meaning that we went from 121 wineries down to 9. So there were only 9 that were able to continue. All the others crumbled with lack of use. That's just Napa Valley. That's not California. That's right. Just Napa Valley. And so with lack of use, you lose memory. You lose the human capital, the human interest to continue something. So you lose the tradition. The facilities decay, and you have major problems. And also, during Prohibition, there were exceptions to it. First of all, the people that advocated Prohibition knew they could not go against the church. And so sacramental wine was allowed. Also, doctors said that wine is healthy and good for you. And as a result, medicinal wine was allowed to be prescribed to people in need. And doctors would go to would recommend wine, and they
so
would
it was
go to
good
the pharmacy.
To be a religious sick person.
Yes, it was. Okay. And but also not only okay. People recognized that wine was a part of the good life, so to speak. And for whatever reason, there were 4 barrels worth of wine allowed to be produced by each head of household. So. Boom. All of a sudden, my grandfather, who immigrated from Italy in 1906 to work in the iron ore mines and then develop a boarding house, he had...
But where?
He was in Minnesota.
First.
He was in Minnesota. Right. He came there in 1906. Thank you for the demarcation. He followed his brother into Minnesota in the Iron Range, worked in the mines. His brother was killed, and he said, I've got to get out of the mines, go above ground. And he developed a boarding house and a bar. And my grandmother, who was a fabulous cook, attracted only the smartest and best of the miners with her food there at the boarding house. But my grandfather took care of the wine. So when Prohibition hits in 1919, all of the paisanes that were there came to my grandfather Cesare and said, Cesare, please, we need wine for our meals. Please, here. They gave him their cold, hard cash. They knew he was a reliable guy. They liked him. He was a very gregarious guy. And at any rate, so with that, in 1919, he began our family in wine, our odyssey, our legacy. He began that as an opportunity. But he knew that wine was central to a meal. It was central to conviviality. Wine is a beverage of generosity. Its whole purpose is to bring people together in health and happiness. And so he began our journey in 1919. So adversity brings possibility.
It sounds like hospitality and wine.
Oh, absolutely.
Between the boarding house and little tavern.
Oh, absolutely.
And just opening the doors.
Well, my grandmother.
Later on, you know, at Mondavi, hospitality was.
Oh, absolutely.
A fixture.
My grandmother, with her incredibly wonderful food, was very outgoing and gregarious. And so it was a social scene. There is a book written with chapters about a number of people called Americans by Choice by Angelo Pellegrini. And he chronicles 7 or 9 individuals. My grandmother was one of them. But he said that she would always set the table and add a couple extra places in case somebody would stop by. And she always had plenty of food, and everybody wanted her food and her companionship and my grandfather as well. So this began a way of life that we are continuing today, a celebration of a meal, a celebration of people, a celebration of wine. And so wine, Petronius said, wine is life. And so there we are.
So Minnesota to California, get me there.
Well, again, being... going to the iron ore mines and then the boarding house. But then when the paisanes came to my grandfather, gave him their cash to go to California, buy grapes, to ship them back to Minnesota for home winemaking, he saw the potential that was there. And so 1919, 20, 21, he moved back and forth. But in 22, he moved his family to Lodi. And so during the period from 1919 to 1933, he continued to ship grapes. And his network grew from just to that one place in Hibbing, Minnesota, or Virginia, Minnesota, where Bob Dylan was born.
Right.
But my father and his 3 siblings were all born there, where Dylan was born.
That's
and,
crazy.
But in 1922, he moved the family to Lodi.
Why Lodi?
Lodi is centrally located in the state of California.
Right.
It is just inland from the Golden Gate. It is in the Central Valley. From there, he could go south to Fresno and Modesto. He could go north. He could go throughout. And he learned about the length and breadth of California viticulture. And he also developed a connection to the marketplace, not just in Minnesota, but along all of the communities that were primarily Italian-based, that love food, and needed wine and wanted to make their own home wine during Prohibition. And so he developed a network that was recognized by a number of the bankers that had foreclosed on a number of wineries throughout the state. And they said, my goodness, Cesare, you've developed such, he was just a young boy when he arrived in 1906, he was 23 years old. He said, you know, you've developed such a great connection to people. Do you think you can do that with wine? He said, of course. He said, well, can you manage a wine? He said, yes, you know I can. So he did. He was asked to manage three wineries, one in Fresno, one in Lodi, and one in St. Helena, Napa Valley. So the sunny St. Helena winery there. So for a number of years, he had the experience not only of the grapes, but then of the wine. Now,
wait, a curiosity. So the bank asks them to step in and run these wineries?
Sure.
I mean, no one owns them. The bank owns them.
They had been foreclosed on. They were foreclosed. During Prohibition.
So he makes them viable working
wineries. Absolutely. They have to be given life. First of all, there has to be legality because Prohibition was repealed in 1933. So it was then, when it became legal, that people were asked, that the bankers asked him to make wine and then sell it. And they were not wine people. They were financial people. They were bankers. So he did. But it is also interesting to note that during the period of Prohibition, grape acreage of expensive grapes, costly grapes, declined precipitously. The German immigrants that had planted the hillsides in Napa Valley and the valley floor, they brought their tradition of hillside vineyards. Well, they were there, but Prohibition, hillside vineyards are more expensive to farm, they are more expensive to plant, and you get less yield. So they are intrinsically quite a bit more expensive. And so they were all abandoned. Napa Valley broadly dropped in half its acreage from 18,000 acres down to 9. And then, but California, by contrast, grew. There, the grape acreage grew because in the during Prohibition, speakeasies were common. And bootleg gin was a big deal. But also, home wine making grew. So grapes that were suitable for shipping, not fine wine quality grapes, but grape shipping quality grapes, grew substantially throughout the state of California. And so, but in the hot, fertile valleys of Modesto, of Fresno, the Central Valley, Napa Valley was decimated. Now, it's also important to note that in Napa Valley, there were a few wineries, Charles Krug, Inglenook, that continued to produce fabulous wines because of the soil and the climate, and they were able to have continuity because of the exceptions that I've mentioned. But America wanted alcohol. America was thirsty for it was hard times. Prohibition ended in 33, but the Depression also began around that time. So people needed to let loose. And so California wine, the industry, responded by 80% of the industry became fortified wine. That's oftentimes people forget that. But and so where do you get the grapes for that? It's in the hot central valleys, cheap grape areas.
But that's what the market wanted? People wanted to sit around and drink jug wine and fortified wine. And that's where their mindset was at that point.
That's exactly right.
The wine industry, whatever it was then, reacted that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And as a result, the California wine identity shifted from being among the very best in the world to being associated with a guy that uses it to keep him warm on the park bench all night.
What years are we talking about now?
Well, this is post-Prohibition, from 33 up onward. And so the destruction of the image writ large for California was pretty horrific. Everybody, even though Napa Valley was still producing terrific wines, you paint with a broad brush, and California wine was destroyed. And in the 50s, 50s or 60s, Baron Philippe, who will come later in the story in a very important way, said that, California wine is like Coca-Cola. It's commercial, it's sweet, it's soulless. And that was the reputation of California wine.
So when and how does it change?
Well,
and obviously your grandfather's out there, and he's not idly standing by running three bank wineries.
No, he saw all of this, and so in 1933, when he had enough awareness of where quality wine was for what he wanted, table wine for the meal, he said, "Bobby, Fresno, Lodi, now go to St. Helena. Go to Napa Valley."
Bobby, so your dad.
My father. When my father graduated from college, Cesare said, knew enough to point him in the right direction. So Cesare
was,
really...
Was Robert the first to go to college generationally? Or?
Yes, he was, because he had two older sisters. The sisters back then didn't go to college. They were
to get married.
Yeah,
for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah, and that's just the way it was. And the boys did go to college. And
Let's mention now? Stanford.
Oh, yes, that's right. That they both went to Stanford. They nailed boxes for grape shipping, and they competed. And Dad would outcompete anybody to box the more boxes than anybody. And Peter also was very good. And not to mention that Dad was president of his class, as was Peter. You know, they both were very gregarious, outgoing people. My father more so, Peter a little more shy, quite a bit more shy. But still, they both were overachievers. Cesare and Rosa, Rosa, boy, lit a fire behind them, and she could do it. My grandfather was very quiet, but Rosa was dynamic, absolutely dynamic. Carissa takes after Rosa, I think.
Wow.
In a very positive way.
First time hearing this. It's
you better
great.
Be a good cook.
She right. is.
I love cooking.
You better have some of those recipes in some drawer somewhere.
I know.
You know?
I don't have to hand those down, Dad. I don't.
Yeah, no, she is. No, but Carissa has a lot of the same spunk that Rosa had. Very gregarious and outgoing, and everybody loved
Rosa.
Well,
when
as they do Carissa.
You know, family is so important. You start looking at each end, and you realize who's like who and who influenced what. I mean, it's crazy.
Mm.
All right, so continue. So
okay.
Where were we?
Where were we? We were trying to, oh, yes. Okay.
Making the move
so,
to their
yeah.
own wineries.
So as a result of the atrophy of the industry, my father recognized, as a result of Prohibition in America, but also the Depression globally, no one did well. You know, you have to realize that we've all come from somewhere. We were... came out of the caves, then wine and was part of what civilized and communities happened because of agriculture. But everything was a commodity in the distant past, and actually not so distant. And wine was no exception. It was, there was very difficult to invest in proper cooperage. And so post-prohibition, the biggest problem with wine was spoilage due to bad cooperage in California, but that was also around the world. Old barrels that people didn't understand about microbiology, they didn't understand about cleanliness, really. They didn't understand about all the spoilage that could take place or how to set things up for success. And even if they knew how, they didn't have the financial wherewithal to do it. So there was a commodity mentality for grains, for grapes, for wine, for everything. So when Cesare was moving along, even at Charles Krug, there was a big focus, well, even at Sandy St. Helena, focus on sanitation, cleanliness, health. The people in Napa Valley continued to pursue good things, but writ large, there was problems. So my father began to work at Sunny St. Helena Winery in 1936 and continued to be a part of that, people noticed that they were producing good wine and that they were, but it was all bulk wine at the time. So again, the owners of then Charles Krug, with the Moffat family, approached my father and said, you know, we are going to be getting out of the wine business, but we've seen that you are very good at what you're doing. Would you be interested in purchasing Charles Krug? And so my father races home to Lodi from St. Helena and talks like a Dutch uncle to his father, who would not say a word, quiet, quiet, quiet. And the story goes that he was so enthusiastic, he had a plan as to how he could buy it, how he could operate it, and it was talking like a Dutch uncle to Cesare, and Cesare's quiet man, he's a quiet man, he's always a quiet man, doesn't say anything, he goes up to bed. My father
is like vibrating.
My father's vibrating there, he is saying, we've got to do this, Mom, Rosa, please talk to us. She said, don't worry, I'll take care of it. And she goes up to bed. The following morning, Dad's up early, and Cesare comes down and says, when do we go to St. Helena?
Wow.
And then there was a famous story of them meeting the bankers in San Francisco, and they come in and share the time of day, and just, hello, Cesare, hello, Robert. And a phone, he receives a call, and they didn't talk about anything, but the answer that the banker had was, oh, no, I've just sold Charles Krug to Cesare Mondavi and his family. They had not talked about anything.
Wow.
And so, but they did end up, Cesare was able to buy, at my father's urging, Charles Krug for $75,000. And it was 150 acres of land in Napa Valley. It was the winery. It was the stable. It was all this infrastructure that was, albeit in disarray, but needed tremendous upgrading. But it was a big deal. And it was then that my family bottled its first wine, was from either 43 or 44.
Was the first vintage?
Was the first vintage of bottled wine.
And the vines, or a lot of them, were there? Not.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
So they didn't have to plant.
Well, they were.
They started to.
But they had relationships. My father had been there since 36, Cesare since 33. So people knew them.
Right.
And so there was a lot of, and Napa Valley became an Italian community. The Martinis were there. So many of the other families were there. And it was a little Italy post-Prohibition. And it was quite amazing. But what Krug invested in was sanitation, cleanliness, people that cared about the quality of wine, the table wine, not fortified wine, but table wine. And there was also investment put into the new building. When I was a boy, we had a slide that we showed of the groundbreaking for the new building in 1959. And in that new building, they put glass-lined tanks.
Mm.
Glass-lined tanks to ferment, cold ferment white wines. My uncle became famous for his innovations of cold fermentation that really revolutionized white wine making, particularly. Red wine making was still very short maceration period.
Take a sideways thing for a second, because you're the winemaker. By introducing cold fermentation, which was an innovation, mm-hmm. What did that do? How did that change the wine? You know, why was it good? Was it only stylistically? Was it preservation? What did it
do? Well, there was a number of things about that. First of all, it was clean. Glass-lined tanks are easy to clean.
So nothing to worry about there.
Cold retains the freshness and the flower and the fruit. There is more vibrancy that stays in the wine. It is easier to care for a clean wine than one that's messed up with all kinds of microbial disaster. So it was naturally more flavorful, more flowery, more fruity, more what people were accustomed to. Back then, the reference was German wines. German wines were very popular in America during that period of time. So fresh, flowery, fruity was all a part of what America was in love with.
Right.
during that period of time.
But you know what you're not saying, and Napa became famous for it, is buttery and popcorny. It wasn't that.
Oh, no, it wasn't that at all.
Yeah,
no.
Let's not go off on that. What I want you to do is, I want you to, you answered the question. I want you to finish the history part. So the Mondavis are in full control of the Krug Winery. Cesare is there. Robert's there. You grow up, literally.
I grew up. My grandfather stayed in Lodi at the time. That was his primary residence. He, of course, had a place there in St. Helena, right next to ours, on the Charles Krug property. But he also had the continuing grape shipping business to care for and all the relationships there. And my grandfather knew that it was so important to not only have a good quality product, but also then be able to stay connected with your customers. My father tells the story of one of the first trips that Cesare took Robert to on a sales trip. He brought him here to New York and places along the way, but they were standing in line to Barbetta's restaurant.
On 40 and, Restaurant Row.
Well, I'm not sure where it is,
they're famous. They have a beautiful garden in the back.
Well, he was standing in line to get into it. All the paisanis were there wanting to get into this fabulous restaurant. And Cesare and Robert are there standing in line. This fellow comes out and he comes up to my grandfather and said, Cesare, hey, how are you? So it's been a long time since I've seen you. What are you doing here? He said, well, we're presenting our wines. I wanted to show my son some of the people that we've met along the way. And Robert, I'd like you to meet Mr. Giannini. This is A.P. Giannini, the founder of the Bank of America, or the Bank of Italy at the time.
Wow.
And my father always, you know, respected his father, but he had no clue as to how well-respected he really was. And so when Robert, who knew who the founder of the Bank of Italy to become the Bank of America, he was flabbergasted at this diminutive little guy, his father, Cesare. And so it was really quite amazing.
He says he grew 10 feet
right.
in his mind that right. day, seeing him looking at his dad is how I've heard
that's
story
a cool
too.
Story.
Yeah, it is a cool story. And it shows to me, it shows the importance of my grandfather was a man of his word. He was respected, and relationship was everything. Relationship and personal connection was everything. And having something you're proud of, a product you're proud of, whether it's grapes or wine, and having that personal connection and that trust that develops. And but to do it in a humble way. And also in a proud way.
Right.
So
the Krug Winery, Robert and Peter, your grandfather, are running the wine for many years.
Yes.
Take me towards, you know, into the 50s,
the 60s. Into the 50s and 60s, you know, Prohibition, the Depression lasted formally 33 to 39. And then the Second World War, and all of these things suppressed capability. Peter was in the war, World War II, on supplying things. He was never on the front line, but
right.
he was in the war as a soldier. Dad had an exception to that because he had flat feet, and he also had to run the company. And America knew that you needed to have a healthy business to carry on with the business of being America and the business of supplying all the armaments. So that carried on. Peter came back, got in charge of the wines, and made a lot of innovations, cold fermentation, cleanliness, all of that. But the industry was still under financial duress. The image of California wine was still painted negatively. Napa Valley was not known. As a young boy in the late 50s, early 60s, we would go skiing and up at Tahoe, at Heavenly Valley, and you'd be sitting on the chair with somebody from the city, and they say, hi, how are you? Great day, wonderful snow, where are you from? Napa Valley.
No idea?
Napa Valley. That's right. Isn't that where that insane asylum is? I said, yeah, that's right. Napa State Hospital is.
Isn't there one other notable place?
There was other memorable place, and that was the Veterans Home.
The Veterans Home.
The Veterans Home was. It is still there, yeah. And it's one of the important homes for veterans that have served in the services. So. But that was the recognition of Napa Valley. It was not known, and if it was known, it was for the Veterans Home or...
So different now.
It is so different now.
But, and the reason it's different, and the reason why this conversation is so unique is because, I wouldn't say singularly, but I would say in a big impact, Robert had an effect... on why Napa,
oh, absolutely.
You know, became. I mean, you know, with the pushing of his father and obviously Peter there and all that. But Krug, I guess, gets into stride. And then there's the story where Robert leaves Krug. Take me to that
That's
point.
Right.
What year is
sure,
that?
Sure, sure. Well, Charles Krug had innovated a lot of things. They were very well known for their white wines. They had gold medals. But Cesare says, Bobby, you can't eat gold medals. You can't eat gold medals. So the business was always struggling. And there are ups and downs, even in the most successful of times. But these were not successful times. And so when you have business under duress, the people, the share owners, the family, has challenges. But Dad would be out promoting the wines, identifying the wines with the finest of images when, in fact, the business was not doing incredibly well. And so jealousies began, suspicions began, frustrations grew. My father was, John Kennedy was in the White House.
This is early 60s.
And this was in 63. And invited the president of Italy to come. And so he invited a number of people that had made a name for himself of Italian descent. And my father was invited to the White House, and he scurried around and tried to figure out, gosh, how do we do this? You know, Marge and I have got to go. And so he found, but he couldn't. Good. So he bought a mink coat on discounted on sale over time and had this mink coat and went to the White House. He forgot to pay the taxi, so he was everybody comes up in limousines. He forgot to pay the taxi, and he's in the waiting line, and people come up, Mr. Madavi, you forgot to pay your taxi. So he had to go back and
That's
pay the taxi.
That's a bad look. That's funny. He was so anxious.
But he was very nervous, you know, and very, very insistent upon this being right and an important thing. But the myopics of it, from back home, from people that weren't doing all that great, was a bit disturbing. And so people said, oh, you stole from the company. My father said, I never stole from the company. You stole from the company. He said, you say that one more time and I'm going to hit you. And so there was a famous blow in the vineyard. And
that
so
was the Peter Robert fist fight.
That was a Peter
true
Robert.
True or not is out there in the ether.
Well, it is true.
Okay.
It is true. And because the company was also having tough financial times, the bankers put Dad on leave. And my grandmother put my father on leave. My grandfather had died in 1959, and this is in 1963. And so it took 4 years for my grandfather's goodwill and steady helm
to wear off.
To wear off and have the sibling rivalries.
It's not a bad run, 4 years. Sometimes it's 4 months, you know?
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
That is true. But it was tough times. And so, at any rate, Dad was put on leave of absence and told that, you know, just to be a good boy. And also that my brother couldn't work there. Mike was graduating from college. And that, and so effectively, it was an invitation to leave.
Was Michael going to... His intentions were to go
into absolutely.
So that was a That was a bad hit.
That was a deal breaker, okay, as far as my father was concerned. And so he, that was in 1965. So
he says, I got to do my own thing.
And so my father, with all of the value that he had built up at Charles Krieg, was still bound there, but he had people that believed in him and put up the money. He had a fellow who had a bundle of money who put up my father's equity. He never wanted anything back. He never wanted to be paid back. He wanted a job.
So he started with a few partners.
He started with two partners.
And that was currency in the market from being good, being around, relationships.
Absolutely. Okay. And then that was in 1966. And Robert Mondavi Winery at the time was the first brand new winery to be built in Napa Valley since Prohibition.
Groundbreaking was in 66?
Groundbreaking and the first harvest was in 1966. So it was very quick. Louis Martini Winery was the first winery in 1933, right upon repeal, but using old technology, using concrete fermenters, redwood fermenters, things like that. But Robert Mondavi was the first brand new stainless steel tanks, German ovals, French oak barrels.
The parcel, tell me where the parcel was. I know it's mid-Napa Valley.
Yes.
On the...
Yeah, it was...
Whose was it? Where did it come from?
Well,
how big was it?
The Martin Stelling was a successful real estate fellow from San Francisco who owned a lot of land in Napa Valley. And my father knew that this one area was really good for Cabernet. And so Louis Martini Sr. had also told him that this is such a great site. And so Dad bought 12 acres to put the winery on there. Now, I think you might have heard of it. It's called Tokalon, only the most famous vineyard in Napa Valley now. Back then, nobody knew anything about Napa. People didn't even know Napa Valley.
Well, nobody was putting Tokalon vineyard on the bottle.
There were a few. There was. I've got bottles that say Tokalon on it from Hamilton Crab, well before Prohibition. And so it was famous, but then again, because of Hamilton Crab prior to Prohibition, all of that was lost by this time. And you just had to stay in business. And so things were going. But Dad did a number of things. He focused. The winery model of its day had made everything from soup to nuts. It had sparkling wine, it had fortified wine, it had generic wines, Chablis, Rhine.
I mean, Chenin
Moselle.
Was big then, right?
Well, that came later too, but then the claret, Burgundy, it was all generic wines. And the job of the winemaker was to repress faults, keep the microbes out, and to conjure up these blends. And so the term winemaker is not used in Europe. It's a wine grower. People grow grapes and make wine. But in California, because it was under financial duress, you couldn't own all of it together, except with rare exceptions. But there are grape growers and winemakers. But the winemakers were there to repress fault. And I think it was in 1966 that we shifted our thinking away from repression of fault due to off-cooperage to enhancement of virtue. Because all of a sudden, Dad had set us up for success. He had set up where cleanliness was fundamental, where stainless steel was easy to clean, where the cooperage was new. All of that was set up for success, and it led to immediate positive response by the industry, by fellow winemakers, and everybody said, wow, that's the right way to go.
So he took the best of everything and incorporated it into the winery. And is it fair to say, and maybe I'm wrong, that was Carissa, she just dropped the spit thing.
Is it fair to say, and
I may be wrong, but... Did he focus on becoming a red wine specialist? I mean, was that...
No. Initially, he did focus, but he focused on strictly varietal wines. There were no generics, and so that was unusual. Mike Gergish pointed that out to me, saying, you know, that's a pretty amazing thing. Everybody talks about all the investments he made, which was amazing, but also that he took us closer to the vineyard, closer, because otherwise it was a blend from all over the place to the taste of the winemaker. But he took it a little bit closer to the vine, closer to the vineyard, and that was also revolutionary. So he had a clarity of focus.
Even though it was revolutionary, was it more of like a European model? Or
Not quite. Not yet.
Not yet.
It was making, he would buy grapes from throughout the valley for that, and it was more of a hybrid where it would be an assemblage. It would more of a négociant style of operation,
right,
where you'd buy grapes, you'd vinify it, and then you would, and then blend, and then sell. So, but it wasn't until later that we were able to secure more vineyards and do more.
When you say later, 3, 4, 5, 7 years,
oh, many,
acquisition
many years,
of property.
Many years. In fact,
was
Robert
a lot of it contiguous and in other places?
Yes, my father was able to purchase for Charles Krug and then have it come back to Robert Mondavi in 79. There was a big lawsuit that between my father and my uncle, the board of Charles Krug and my father, Joe Aliotta, the then mayor of San Francisco, mm-hmm. was there's lots of side stories. I probably shouldn't get too far into it. But the But the main line is that at Robert Mondavi, my father stopped at nothing to do the best. Now, I worked there with my father. Warren Winiarski was the first winemaker that my father worked with, so I had a chance to, well, put the first valves on the first tanks in 1966.
So you're going to proceed to talk about an alumni that's off the charts.
Yeah.
Right?
Warren Winiarski is a wonderful man, he left Robert. He was worked with us for a couple of years. Went off on to then establish Stag's Leap Wine Cellars. That becomes famous, very famous in 1976 for an important reason. Mike Gergich succeeded him, and Mike Gergich worked with us. And I had the opportunity of working both with Mike and with Warren. For a couple of years, they reported to my father, who was guiding the wine.
How old were you then?
Well, in 1966, I was 15.
So this is you're a high school kid.
I was high
school. But you're entrenched in the winery.
Well, yeah.
Because you're interested.
Well, I was interested, and it's the summer job. We were expected to work during our time off. We were expected to work, and we did, and it was interesting and fascinating. It was the way to learn. You know, we clean the toilets of Robert Mondavi.
Clean the toilets, clean the barrels.
Yeah, clean the barrels, mowed the lawn with a collared shirt, pressed pants. Had to be right. My father made every decision.
Was that a Robert thing, the collared shirt and all that?
Absolutely.
Like you're going to look good cleaning?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely.
That's the hospitality history.
Well, absolutely. You had to put your best foot forward in every regard, even if you were cleaning the toilets and also, if you're going to clean the toilets, you're going to do a damn good job of it. And if you're cleaning them, be proud of that. And if somebody else is doing it, you be proud of them. And also, if you're going to dig a ditch, dig the best damn ditch you can. That's good advice.
The advice is be good at anything, anytime.
No matter what you're doing.
Whatever it is.
If it's worth doing.
And support that in others.
If it's worth doing, be proud of it and be proud of the people that are doing that. You may not do it, but be proud of that. And so we are. And we, anyway, where were we going?
Wait, so let me take this. So acquisition of land, build the winery, create the innovations. When do you start hitting your stride? You know, when are you chugging out wine, getting, you know, some of the accolades or recognition?
So we're talking
66.
Oh, 66.
Yeah, we're in 66.
Because I want to, you know, I want to accelerate it to when you jump in. I mean, you know, we're talking, 30 years making wine there?
Yeah.
You know, I want to get to that point.
Yeah. Dad, but that, he's getting to, like, he worked with all the first winemakers and went to UC
and
Davis.
And Zelma Long as well.
Zelma.
And, you know, so many people, Phil Fries, Genevieve Jansons, we had the best, the best. It was, we were referred to as the University of Robert Mondavi because we were so committed to discovering what makes wine, great wine, tick.
More than anyone else was doing.
More than anyone
Just
else for fine wine.
The and
Gallows,
detail.
The Gallows also, to their credit, established the foundation for California wine. If you don't have a strong foundation, then the top doesn't go. So I think there was a tremendous amount of regard between my father and Ernest and Julio Gallo. They knew each other well. And the baseline of California wine really was the Gallows. And then my father was pursuing the best. That's not where the money was, but that's where that's where our heart was. And
but the story goes to that. But
well, it does.
We'll get to that.
So the thing that's interesting in 66, talking about the quality of the wines and then the reputation that came afterwards, in 66, there had to be a shift away from open-top fermenters to the closed stainless steel. The first vintages developed a lot of hydrogen sulfide. They were reduced because the vineyards were cared for the same way and fairly heavy-handed to protect them. But it so the first wines were a bit problematic. But by 69, the 69 vintage is the vintage that the Robert Parker of his day, Robert Lawrence Balzer, he was the wine columnist from the LA Times, Los Angeles Times. And Robert Lawrence Balzer had a tasting of all the best Cabernets of California, all 23 of them, and all of the winemakers that were responsible for them. And he had a blind tasting. And at the end of the tasting, Robert Lawrence Balzer comes up to my father and said, "Oh, Bob. Oh, I'm so sorry. You don't even recognize your own child." Bob was gay. He was way ahead of his time. He was a Tibetan monk.
Interesting guy.
You're a fascinating guy and proudly out there in so many ways. Good for him. Absolutely. But he said, oh, Robert, you don't even recognize your own child. But it came out first place. And it was in the news everywhere.
So that
localized
was
basis.
A defining moment,
the
turning
69
point.
Cabernet, which was then publicized, I think, in 71 or 72. And so a lot of people followed what my father had done. And
the closed
top. Well, they began having
French oak.
Well, French oak, stainless steel tanks, cleanliness, and a belief that Napa was beginning to turn the corner. And if you work hard, you could actually be in business in wine, not just go out of business in wine, which is the way it was prior.
It's crazy.
So
when do you go off to college? What year are we talking about?
I went
graduated
to
the baldest thing is in 69, you
well,
said?
Well, I was graduated high school
summer.
In 69 and then in 74 is when I graduated from college.
With a degree in viticulture and enology
from
UC Davis.
Davis.
Yeah.
So you come out of there, things are going...
Well, I was reticent to get in.
Things are kind of habit, but you jump right into the business, like
well,
I said.
I was hesitant to get in until
Why?
I went, well, because my father and my uncle were fisticuffs during this time. It was during the longest court case in Napa Valley history.
I didn't realize all that stuff was playing.
And it was a backdrop for that, family strife and all of that. And I didn't want to get into the wine business until I went to Europe in 1970. And my father...
Is this pre-Davis or during Davis?
It was just between freshman and sophomore year at Davis.
And what was the motivation to go there? The family had some great relationships.
It was a summer trip, but my father gave me a whole list of people to visit. And I visited a few of them. And notably, the first winery I went to in Burgundy was with Robert Drouin. Robert Drouin himself took me through with Harry Serlis, the president of the Wine Institute, happened to be there, and I got tacked into that because of respect for my father. But it was being in Bordeaux at our cooperages, at the cooperage of Louis Demtos. The Demtos family had an
one of the great coopers.
Terrence one of the,
them.
Oh, absolutely.
They were
but they were a family-owned cooperage there, and we called him up saying, well, can we make an appointment next week? He said, no, we're going to come and pick you up right now. And it was the buddy I was traveling with was on a limited budget, and so we were camping out and having Knorr soup, you know, the dry packets. Yeah. And you can't stay there. Come with us. So they swoop in and showed us all the first growths of Bordeaux, all of these great places. But the thing that really seared in my mind, that they swooped us up and brought us to a family dinner on Sunday afternoon and evening. I was so hungry from eating Norse soup that I ate three entrecote bordelaise, grilled over the cuttings.
Nice.
There were three generations of the Demtos family. It was at Obailly, which Véronique Saunders today runs. It is Louis Demtos's wife was a Saunders, and they owned Obailly at the time. And so that's where we were. And it was absolutely fabulous. I said, wow, this is amazing to me that family can get along in the wine business. And it was so romantic and bucolic, and the wines were terrific. And it was, wow, it was heaven. And so that said, wow, we can do something here. We can continue with a family business.
Separate of the Krug thing, you can go back and, you know, this world and environment.
Absolutely. My daughter is here, not by accident.
No. All right, so maybe wrong choice of words, but you stop putzing around in Europe, you come back home, you learn a lot and make great relationships in Europe.
Yes.
The cooperage thing and all that turns out to be an important part of the wine.
Oh, absolutely.
So you kind of hit the ground running.
Yes.
You get out, you know, in the field literally.
Sure.
And you're, winemaking. So you brought something up, and this is a good time to bring it in. Wine grower versus winemaker.
Yes.
You're...
Well,
What do you see yourself at, you know, when you get there?
Well, still, most of our research work was in the cellar. And we began to get closer to the vineyard. But we realized, so that continued for some time. But Dad was able to attract the best. You know, Warren Winiarski, Mike Gergich, Zelma Long. People don't know Zelma as well, but she is a brilliant woman that, after working with us for 10 years... went on to be the winemaker at CIMI and the president of CIMI.
Right.
And she is consulted with many other
one of the great
winemakers.
Women in wine,
and,
for sure.
She really is. She's a wonderful person and a brilliant mind. And Phil Fries also, now her husband, but then Phil was our vine whisperer. He could understand viticulture in a way that others didn't.
I wanted to get to that. So Zelma and Warren and all those guys, their focus was more in the cellar. And did Fries make that transition out into the field, you know, which is my wine grower, winemaker
yes.
question?
Well, Paul Kolobi was the grower representative for us. He would be connected to the growers and help guide them as to what was going on. We did a lot of research. Phil was a PhD in biochemistry and loved vineyards. But we did a lot, began to do a lot of work in the vineyards. But to show how things were at the time, as we began to notice that different vineyards had different personalities, we had two vineyards at Robert Mondavi, the Wapo Hill or the Oak Knoll Vineyard, as it was then known, and the winery Tokalon. And we said, you know, we've got these two vineyards. They're very different. Went to Davis and said, you know, we've got one that's really good and one that needs to be better. Could you help us understand them? And the vineyards people from Davis went in. They checked out the vineyards at Tokalon. They figured the wines at Oak Knoll. And they said, you do have two vineyards, but we disagreed as to which one was better. They looked at the green foliage that was healthy and wonderful from Oak Knoll, and said, that's your good vineyard. And the one that was older and virused and all kinds of problem, which produced great wine, that's your bad vineyard. Well, okay, so we had to go beyond what you see is not always what you get. And you had to get down, and ultimately it is the land, it is the drainage, it is the age of the vine, and it is understanding. But it took a long time to really understand and drill down to why. And I think that just as the repression of fault and technical elements captured our day, our love of Burgundy really ignited our passion about going beyond that. So what I mean by that is the winemaking of the day was predicated upon a strong Cabernet-like wine. So, you know, Davis was important. The connection to Davis was very important. And then, kind of I overstated, but as all red wines should be fermented at 75 degrees, you genuflect and say amen, and and to St. Davis and you do it, and then all white wine should be fermented at 59 degrees and you genuflect, say amen, and you do it, because St. Davis said that. So, okay, well, we did that. But then we got inspired by Burgundy, and we saw that they didn't do any of that. And Pinot Noir is really the canary in the coal mine. It was the variety that demanded well-drained soils, that demanded cool climate, it demanded specificity in the vineyard, low crop, and also a gentle hand in the cellar. If you treated Pinot Noir like you would any other red,
it's a finicky grape,
it would just be destroyed.
Right.
And so we learned what allowed Pinot Noir to glow, and that is its own natural resiliency, treating it tenderly. And so Pinot Noir demanded tenderness, and Cabernet didn't. It didn't
but the
demand
idea
it. It
that
just
you
it.
Had to differentiate and pay attention was a whole new approach, because everything was
So we had a Stanley the computer that and temperature control in all the tanks. We could have temperature controlled different temperatures for different stages of fermentation for different varieties. We began to experiment with stems. Again, Pinot Noir helped us learn about
using the stems.
Well, in Burgundy, many houses will de-stem completely, and many houses will have whole cluster.
Right.
And so we began to look into that, you know, whether it would be whole cluster or completely de-stemmed, whole berry, cracked berry.
Is this stem for Cab or for your Pinots?
For Pinot Noir.
For your Pinots.
For Pinot Noir. Cabernet.
So you were following suit in what Burgundy was.
Yeah, we tried to identify what the different techniques were that led to great successes internationally. We had to benchmark success and
but
be aware of
the failures.
It was
kind of all over the place, though. I mean, one winery was amazing and did whole cluster, and another was amazing and de-stemmed.
Well, it's true, but there were certain cause and effect, and ultimately we would try what they did there in our situation for our palate. And so all this research work that we did, we were able to do, and we would do these duo trio tastings, and we would do all these things to see, was it not just, can we tell a difference between these practices? Also, which do we prefer? And I got to be involved in all that. I got to help guide all of that and participate with brilliance that came from anywhere and everywhere. And then also capture the best of it and figure out a way of acting only on the best of ideas and then trying them and keeping at it and keeping at it and keeping at it. What is good in this area may not be good in that area. What is good this year may not be good in that year. So it's
that's
all
where it has to be, not what
yes.
it was.
Yeah, and Pinot in Burgundy, because Pinot Noir is so sensitive, it's not an accident that they are the ones that speak most articulately of the importance of terroir, of site. And there, the valley floor is wonderful. They have the village wines that are all distinctive up and down according to climate and all in specifics, but the great wines are always on the sides of the hill. Premier Cru, Grand Cru, Premier Cru, those are the ones that were really in highest regard. It is also interesting to note, to go back and see that the great wines of the world at the time particularly were owned by either the church or royalty. And it was the church in Germany and in Burgundy that the monks said, okay, we are going to produce wine to honor God. These are for the sacraments. And so we are going to stay out of the way and allow the glory of God's land to show through the grape, and we will do as little as we can. And that is what happened in Germany.
That is the beginning of what we call the low intervention movement.
Well, and also the beginning.
They were monitoring. They were taking meticulous notes and studying and
Low intervention with research.
Yeah.
Oh, and also the beginning of appellations. The beginning of recognition that this site is really good, that site is not so good. And so it was really the church again that led the way, and it was also the royalty that had the persistence to understand how to go about doing that. The rest of the mere mortals had to deal with the financial vagaries, and they couldn't carry on. They couldn't do what was necessary because the hillsides always are intrinsically more costly, and, poor normal sloths couldn't afford that.
That's right.
So,
all right. So, we have to do a bunch of things. We have to talk about continuum, but there's a very important chapter that we could probably do a show on. But I want you to kind of quickly. Robert Mondavi Winery becomes iconic, successful, influential. The winery goes public. That's what happens when you get good. People say, hey, we want to buy you.
It's also what happens
that
when
changes
you have-
the world. And in a way, that's the beginning of an end for you. That's the beginning of a beginning.
Yes.
So just don't spend a lot of time on it. But the family takes the winery public. The public part of it doesn't necessarily want to carry on the vision you know, your dad and the type of wines.
Right.
So close that chapter for
me. Sure. Okay. Well, the winery went public because the phenomenon of phylloxera put a huge pressure on the vineyards that we owned at the time. The reinvestment in replanting. And phylloxera also allowed us to begin to ask questions about rootstock, about density of planting, the right variety in the right area. So phylloxera had a huge negative impact, forced us to go public, but also stimulated a lot of research in the vineyards, and that was enormous. But going public also allowed us to have the capital, which is where I think you were leading me, to be able to do a lot of things that we
But the other part's interesting. I mean, the phylloxera and all the research and the understanding and realization.
Everybody prior to phylloxera just carried on doing what had been successful before, successful enough. But with phylloxera, nothing was successful enough.
Right.
So you had to go beyond that. And so a lot of questions started happening in the vineyard with a passion throughout the valley. And communication among growers was enhanced. Discovery about different rootstocks, different clones, all of that. It was just on overdrive viticulturally. From the wine perspective, it allowed us to realize a number of aspirations that we had. Last night, Carissa told a story of when my father took my brother and I to Europe in 1973. I took the finals from Davis early and late that year to get on this trip. But we went Bordeaux, Burgundy, up Alsace, Champagne, into the Rheingau and the Mosel, down into Piemonte, down into Tuscany. At the end of the trip, it was a fabulous trip.
Pretty good.
It was Zoom. Oh, my God, Zoom. Rapid Roberts trip through Europe. But then at the end of it, he said, you know, one day, we'll make wine here again. Cesare and Rosa had come from Italy, from the Modica area. But we were in Tuscany, and he said, someday we'll do this. And I never forgot that. So when we did go public, Dad was also curious about all these other areas. He was curious about Chile. And so met Eduardo Chadwick, and I didn't want to go there. I wanted to go to Italy. And but then I went kind of kicking and screaming and fell in love with the possibilities of Chile and in love with, and I saw a like-minded soul in Eduardo, who was dynamic, smart, curious about great wine, and he would go on to become the Robert Mondavi of Chile, and we would go on to produce Seña, which was an aspiration to do, and we've even skipped over Opus. Opus is not yet.
Well, we'll come back for a second.
But it was, and then we also, I wanted to go to Italy, and so Burton Anderson was a wine writer, the book on Italy, literally. He took us around to the various areas, but ultimately we decided to be in Tuscany because we love the wines, love the vibrancy that the wines had and the tone that they had. I met Vittorio Frescobaldi, fell in love with him, and the potential of his properties. He had a tremendous number of properties, but it seemed that they had not really capitalized on that. We had developed a strong selling network, and we were perhaps a little bit farther in advance in doing a lot of research, and we felt we could have a collaboration that would be terrific. And so Luce was born in Montalcino. But it was a dynamic time.
Both of you had a hand in it, but Ornellaia popped up. Just tell me, you know, Ornellaia is truly one of the great wines in the world. You guys had a hand in it.
Well, it is also interesting because the wine world was small back then, and Piero Antinori has three daughters. Two of them worked with us at Robert Mondavi, and he wanted his daughters to learn about the business and learn about hospitality.
Right.
And learn.
They worked in the winery and
they
hospitality.
They worked in hospitality.
Alessia's been on the show. Piero's been on the show twice.
Okay.
You know, it's a wonderful
family. Yeah, they are.
And Lamberto's been on twice.
Yeah, no, it's
you know, I can't
terrific.
Have these guys. You're supposed to have everybody on once, but I can't have these guys on enough.
Well, this
you know?
Is not enough. This is...
Yeah. Well,
there you
okay.
go.
So,
but wait, we have to take a quick
more
break.
To go.
Okay.
But we're talking to Tim Mondavi. Tim Mondavi's winery is Continuum. But I want to say something that this probably will be the longest show in the history of the Grape Nation.
Oh, no. I'm sorry.
And that's not a negative. That's not a negative. Tim, I want you to be prepared that we're not done yet. And I want my listeners to know that, you know, when you talk to Tim and, you know, you talk about the family and everything they had their hand in, it's hard to do within an hour. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're just going to broach on Opus 1, and then we're going to get into Continuum, and I have a bunch of questions on that. Tim does not leave without being subjected to our wine list, and then we do a final evaluation of the 2019 Continuum for our weekly wine sip. So you're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
I'm Chava Perivan, co-host of Agave Road Trip on HRN, here to talk about 818 Tequila. 818 creates their tequila using traditional methods at a family-owned and operated distillery in Jalisco, Mexico. From the blue agave they grow to their recycled glass bottle, 818 emphasizes the earth's importance in all they do. Their distillery runs on biomass and solar power, which means they don't rely as much on fossil fuels and are able to reduce their carbon footprint. Their labels, corks, and boxes are all certified by the Forest Stewardship Council as coming from sustainability-managed forests. 818 is a proud member of 1% for the Planet, through which they support HRN as well as Sacred, my organization in Jalisco, where together we transform agave byproducts and water waste into adobe bricks that are donated to local infrastructure projects, like a local library in Zapotitlán de Vadillo. Visit drink818.com to learn more about their sustainability efforts and find 818 near you. 818 has been part of so many magical nights for me, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
In the heart of Williamsburg, Brooklyn, Lilia combines wood-fired seafood, handcrafted pasta, classic Italian cocktails, and warm hospitality. Since 2016, it's been celebrated as a neighborhood gathering place, bringing the best of Italy to New York City. Lilia is one of over 8,000 restaurants that leverage Bento Box to power their digital front door, including their website, gift cards, event management, and more. Bento Box is a marketing and commerce platform built specifically for the hospitality industry. With Bento Box, get discovered, make more money, and engage your diners so you can deliver great hospitality both in person and online. Visit getbento.com/chef today to learn more and get your first month free. That's getbento.com/chef.
Okay, we're back. We're back with my guests, Tim and Carissa Mondavi. Tim, we're going to put behind us the final history part. I'm glad we talked about Frescobaldi and Luce and Ornellaia, the Sania thing, because I think he's a soulmate to the family. You know, that was nice to talk about him. The Opus thing, which, you know, truly was one of the big stories in Napa wine. Just take that where you want to take that. I mean, how that came about.
Sure. Well, if we go back, the masters of wine of England were beginning to be, they were always the most open-minded about great wine. They were the first ones to recognize that Napa Valley had potential. And Hugh Johnson came to the winery with a very young Jancis Robinson. And
she was on 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I know, I saw that. And so Hugh was doing a videotaping, which was innovative in the day, and
right.
We were there, and his intro at the time with Jancis in the sideline and talking to my father was, he said, you know, the wine world was a tranquil sea. There was an abundance of wine, and it was very quiet until there was a pebble thrown into it, and that pebble landed in Oakville, and the person that threw that pebble was Robert Mondavi, and the ripples of that pebble have awakened the wine world. And so that was something that came along, and it's actually quite true, because with that, a lot of people began to be curious about Napa Valley. Among them, Baron Philippe, who was happening to visit California in 1968. His second wife was from Santa Barbara, California, and he had a chance to see what was going on. His first wife died in the concentration camps. That's a story in and of itself. But at any rate, so he came to my father in 1968. He saw in my father a like-minded fellow, aspiring to always do better. Baron Philippe, the Mouton Rothschild was a second growth at the time.
That's crazy.
And he was developing a museum with his second wife there that to talk about the artifacts of wine through civilization. It's the best museum of wine in the world. But they were both aspiring souls. My father was also aspiring to have California be recognized at a far higher level, Napa Valley at a far higher level. So, and was doing all of these great programs, the Great Chefs of France, many other things that were happening. So Baron Philippe approached my father in 68, but it was too early. He came again in 78, 10 years later,
wow,
to form Opus in 1979. And Opus was the first, Baron Philippe was able to have Mouton Rothschild reassessed from a second growth to a first growth in 1973, when he was criticized and said, you know, how is it that you worked it out that you would be, so no. They evaluated all of Bordeaux, all the classification of 1855, and found only one meriting change. he was quite something. But he was a dynamic fellow with ambitions.
You start that partnership.
And with Philippine de Rothschild.
Right.
And Opus was, to a great extent, Philippine's coming out party.
Yeah, she was a very charismatic.
She was, and again, Carissa is a lot like Philippine. Carissa is more, all of these in very intelligent, capable women.
More to live up to than I can.
It is true, Carissa.
Well, you do, Carissa, you forget, Philippine it was a man's game, and she was successful, and she had an incredible presence, and was very effective.
So she was very
kudos.
My dad is very biased and very.
He's your dad.
I am biased.
He's your dad.
I am biased, but I'm also objective.
Correct assessment. But
honored and Baron. It was a man's world, and Baron Philippe had a daughter, and so she was not included in the business at all. But as his health failed, she was brought in, and then she was the owner, and so she guided it. And there were turbulent times early on, but boy, was she powerful. She was effective and absolutely terrific. But Opus was her coming out party, and she was criticized because she, together, we helped design Opus One. She in the design with my father and Margaret.
That's a whole show, right?
Oh, boy.
Building it in the ground and the design and all that. Don't go there. But so go ahead. Finish
there's
up.
A lot.
Geothermal crap and all whatever.
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of stories there. But at any rate, she was so proud of Opus. But she was criticized. I remember one time getting in a taxi in Bordeaux and going up to Mouton. And I asked him, what do you think about this first growth? What about this first? And he said, Mouton, no, they are not very good. They're too commercial. They're too commercial. This is the taxi driver, right?
You get knocked for that, right?
So Baron Philippe had this aspiration. But anyway, there was all this pressure. But Philippine was also criticized at a very conservative man's world for hewing so close. She brought Opus One, a party, into the Grand Chez at Mouton Rothschild for the debut of Opus One.
Ah.
It was a huge deal. And she got a lot of blowback for how can you bring this wrong entity, this non-Bordeaux entity, into the sacred room, the Grand Chez of Mouton Rothschild. But she did it. And it was incredible. We also had Leonard Bernstein conducted the Philharmonic Orchestra in Paris at the time. Big deal.
So I was at a Napa wine auction event. You know, they had the Friday and Saturday. It was at Opus.
Mm.
Probably in the 90s. Wolfgang Puck was the chef. Ferrari had like 40 cars lined up. Wolfgang pulled up and won. I think I sat at a table with Michael. And it was just... you know, a bigger than life event. You know,
absolutely.
Wolfgang then, the Ferraris, Opus, it was just, it's sort of Mouton Rothschild and Opus, the rest is history. They both established themselves. I want to talk about Continuum.
You just heard part one of my interview with Tim and Carissa Mondavi. Stay tuned for part two.
The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.